Ken, you've just come back from New Zealand. What were you doing there?
Well, I was in New Zealand. I'm back about maybe 3 weeks now. I was there both working and enjoying myself. The working part of it, I was working in the University of Otago. And in addition to that, then, as usual, of course, I was doing a bit of fishing. And it was a really interesting visit because listeners may remember that a few years ago, I was lucky enough to get to the North Island. And this time I was in the South Island, and it was complete chalk and cheese. I was really surprised. I thought that it would be a bigger version of the North Island, but it was actually quite different. It reminded me so much of Canada because you have this enormous spine of beautiful mountains running down the west coast called the Southern Alps. And the cloud and the rain and so on must rise in order to get over those mountains. And behind it, you have almost desert in some of the locations. And some of those desert areas were absolutely remarkable. They were quite barren looking to look at. And yet there were these beautiful blue rivers and blue lakes spread throughout these desert areas. And the whole island is just so remote. There's only a little over a million people. It's really quite large. It's about the same size as Ireland. But a lot of the people, as usual, live in the towns. So the areas that you're visiting, if you go off-road at all, are truly remote. And it's, again, there's a little bit of a contrast with Canada. Most places in Canada where there are houses, there are cinder tracks, and you can fairly much depend on the tracks. In the South Island in New Zealand, a lot of the roads are real dirt track roads, and a lot of them are just raw gravel. And you need to be really, really careful in terms of driving. And certainly there was quite a number of accidents while I was there. And that's just part of the terrain and part of the story.
Well, it kind of sounds idyllic, but are there problems?
Yes, there are, unfortunately. And I was really surprised and really taken aback. You can divide the South Island at this stage, and I'm going to speak now purely as an amateur in terms of what I observed there. I don't have any great depth of knowledge in terms of what's happening, but I was very shocked by what I saw. You can divide the island as I see it in two. In terms of the foothills and the mountain areas themselves, they're just stunning. They're just absolutely completely pristine, and they're really gorgeous, and they're everything that the brochures would tell you they would be. Yet, when you get into any of the areas where there's an opportunity to farm, including indeed some of the desert areas, and that was what first drew my attention to this, we were going through a valley that, if you can imagine, was brownish looking and very much sunburnt looking, with very sandy soils. And suddenly in front of us, we saw this big, big patch of green. And this patch of green got bigger and bigger as we went along
the field.
Flat area, a massive field. But it was actually a plain rather than a field. And why was it green? I kept saying to myself. And I saw this enormous, almost like a creature, which was in place in one of the sections of this green field. And if you can imagine a massive, great hooping system, one big hoop, one big hula hoop joined onto the other, maybe 500 metres to a kilometre wide with big rubber wheels on it. And out of this big hoop system, there was an enormous quantity of water being sprayed. And this was obviously moving very slowly along the ground. And the green area was divided up by very powerful electric fences. And the electric fences then had very long, narrow fields designated in the brown area. And the brown area was turned to green by the water because it was actually naturally quite rich in terms of nutrients. And in the green areas, there were these huge quantities of cows, really very densely packed cows. And yet there were
like fish farms almost.
It was just
that's
like
what I'm visualizing
it
as you're
was,
saying
yeah,
that.
It was like factory farming without the factory. That was the first thing that struck me. And I was really surprised at this. And obviously, I made some inquiries. And it seems that around 2000, 2005, suddenly in New Zealand, they decided that dairy farming was going to be the big answer. There used to be a share between dairy farming and sheep and so on. But suddenly dairying took hold. And they have a huge opportunity in Asia to be exporting all sorts of different milk products, particularly milk powder. So dairying has now taken off.
Milk. There was a milk intolerance in parts of Asia.
Well, I mean, certainly that's where they said they were exporting a lot of the powder.
No, did I imagine that? Am I wrong?
Yes, they can't. Chinese people apparently are not equipped to digest lactose. It's only in places where there are cattle, traditionally, that the modification occurs in our digestive systems to deal with lactose. Parts of Africa where there are cattle, the people can digest milk. In parts of Africa where there are no cattle, where there's no cattle breeding, they can't. But presumably this is milk powder. And it's used in all kinds of ways other than drinking straight milk.
No, that's a good point because I hadn't come across that. Now they were saying that was where it was exported to. And There are two areas in particular where this has really taken off. One of them is in the North Island, if you could imagine the sort of Midland Plain area, a place called Waikato in the North Island. And then in the South Island, on the east side of the South Island, you have this beautiful area of plains called the Canterbury Plains. And I had an opportunity then to actually see what was happening on the Canterbury Plains. And I thought I had seen intensive farming in Omarama until I got to the Canterbury Plains. And as far as I could see, there was nothing except cows. It was just incredible. And the quantity of water that was being used, obviously that would be something that I'd take particular note of. And there was one river in particular called the Selwyn River, which I'd read a great deal about. And I went looking for the Selwyn River and I couldn't find it. It had basically been abstracted out of existence, apart from very, very small quantities of water in the upper reaches. And that really epitomised what was happening, where you had a situation where there was a vast amount of nutrients being produced by the cattle, where there was a decreasing amount of water to actually dilute these nutrients going into the waterways. And the waterways were really quite heavily polluted. And there's a huge PR battle going on at the moment in New Zealand, just in those localised areas, in relation to the environment. And in recent months, it's got quite bitter, where you have a situation where the farmers have decided that it may be trout anglers that are leading the charge. So they've decided to mount a campaign against trout because they're not a native species. And they're claiming that trout are the wrong species to use as the index of water quality, and that people are looking for too stringent a level of water quality in these particular rivers. Forgetting, I think, that the reason that the trout do so well is because these are beautifully rich, pristine, and in many ways a kind of unique world heritage, these particular rivers in those plains. They're beautiful big rivers, and in reality there must be a balance to be struck between the need, and there is a very real need, obviously, for a small isolated community such as the 4 million people in New Zealand, very real need for them to have a proper standard of living and to have proper exports. But they must, I think, really balance this in terms of the environmental concerns that are being voiced at the moment.
I'm just wondering, you're saying that they're taking huge volumes of water from the rivers, and that's depleting the rivers of water, so the waters might be, or the rivers might be disappearing. Then at the same time, you're saying, well, the water, because of the way there are this intensive farming, that the rivers are heavily polluted now. Are they taking the water from upstream and they're polluting it downstream? What does that work?
The situation is,
because you can't be taking it from one river 100 miles away and polluting another. You're going to take it from the nearest river, presumably.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, obviously, there's
same one that's going to be polluted.
The smaller rivers are the ones that get fully depleted.
Yeah.
But the really big rivers are on the east coast. These are massive great rivers. These are, you know, a good proportion of the size of the Shannon. So they're not going to be fully depleted by any manner or means. It's the tributaries of those rivers that are very often actually depleted. But there's generally what happens is, because of the fact they're quite similar to our rivers here in the Central Plains in Ireland, there's a lot of gravel. So the water is actually under the gravel as well as on top of the gravel. Mm-hmm. So when you take the water out, you'll get ponding. So what you find is you'll find sections of the river that are extremely slow flowing, where the water is isolated in these particular locations and it's trickling through the gravels, joining one standing pond to the next. And that's the worst possible scenario you can have, because you are then going to find that if you have a dry riverbed, and if your cattle are doing what cattle do on the dry riverbed, and then you get a massive flush of water, as you will do in the winter time, and particularly there if you have snow melting and so on, you get a huge shift of this nutrient load into those pools, and they may have the remaining fish species in the pools. Equally, you're spreading the pollution then along the channel in a very, very unsatisfactory way in terms of moving it downstream. And one of the really big rivers that I saw, the biologists that I was working with in the university were saying to me that they had seen very major changes in terms of the overall animals and plants that were in that big river system. And even though the river itself still has an abundance of fish, and in that case, because it's slightly enriched by the all of the tributaries, you're actually getting quite a big production of fish, but it's almost artificial because it's being maintained by these extra nutrients that are going in. So I think they have quite a job on their hand now to strike a balance between the environmental requirements that are there and their efforts to put out a clean green image, and the challenges that are there in terms of trying to indulge in intensive agriculture.
Did you come across any heroes?
Yes, I came across one wonderful hero, a lady called Louise Crute. And Louise is a councillor in Dunedin, and she's leading the charge in the county of Otago. She's done an amazing job in terms of convincing people that they need to manage this themselves, not by regulation, but by understanding. And there's a river called the Shag River just outside of Dunedin, which has just recently won several environmental awards. And from the river being on the brink, literally of extinction due to huge loadings of nutrients and real problems in terms of irrigation, where the farmers are now individually managing their sections of the rivers, they've dropped their expectations in terms of the density of cattle. And that really is a success story. So there are heroes, and I think the heroes hopefully will win out.
Hopefully they will. Ken, thank you very much indeed for that. Stay around because you're going to be interested in meeting Keelan Doyle. He's a marine biologist and he's here to talk about seahorses.